Carol Ann Boone Anderson, Alice Thissen, and Joe McLean spent almost a week with him. Ted seemed to be in excellent spirits and enjoyed driving his friends around the Salt Lake City area. He took them swimming and horseback riding. He and Callie took them one night to a homosexual nightclub. Alice Thissen was somewhat surprised that although Ted said he had been there before, he seemed ill at ease in the gay club. The trio from Washington found Ted's apartment very pleasant. He'd cut pictures out of magazines and tried to duplicate the decor he favored. He still had the bicycle tire hung from the meat hook in his kitchen, and he used that to store knives and other kitchen utensils in a mobile effect. He had a color television set, a good stereo, and he played Mozart for them to accompany the gourmet meals he prepared. During the first week in June 1975, Ted came back to Seattle to put a garden in for the Rogers at his old rooming house, and he spent most of his time with Meg. She still made no mention of the fact that she talked with both the King County Police and the Salt Lake County Sheriff's Office about him. The cases of the missing women in Washington were no longer being played up in local papers. Because neither King County nor the Seattle Police Department could spare the detectives detailed to the task force during the summer when so many of their investigators were on vacation, the task force was to be disbanded until September. Meg and Ted decided to marry the following Christmas, and although they had only 5 days together in June, they made plans for her to visit him in Utah in August. Meg was almost convinced that she had been wrong, that she had allowed Lynn Banks to cloud her mind with suspicions that couldn't have any basis in fact. But time was growing short, far shorter than either Meg or Ted realized. If anything was bothering Ted Bundy's conscience during that summer of 1975, he didn't show it. He was working as a security guard, still managing the building he lived in, and if he drank more and more, drinking was a part of college life. But his grades in law school had continued to drop. He wasn't beginning to live up to the potential of a man with his IQ, his boundless ambition. It was close to 2:30 a.m. on August 16th when Sergeant Bob Hayward, a stocky, balding, 22-year veteran of the Utah Highway Patrol, pulled up in front of his home in suburban Granger, Utah. Bob Hayward is the brother of Captain Pete Hayward, the homicide detective chief in the Salt Lake County Sheriff's Office, but his duties are quite different. Like Washington State, Utah's Highway Patrol deals only with traffic control. But Hayward has the kind of sixth sense that most longtime cops have, the ability to note something that seems just a hair off center. In the balmy August pre-dawn, Hayward noticed a light-colored Volkswagen Bug driving by his home. The neighborhood was strictly residential, and he knew almost everyone who lived along his street, knew the cars that usually visited them. There was rarely any traffic at this time, and he wondered what the Volkswagen was doing there. Hayward threw on his brights so that he could catch the license plate on the Bug. Suddenly, the Volkswagen's lights went out, and it took off at high speed. Hayward pulled out, giving chase. The pursuit continued through two stop signs and out onto the main thoroughfare, 3500 South. Hayward soon was just behind the slower car, and the Volkswagen pulled into an abandoned gas station parking lot and stopped. The driver got out and walked to the rear of his car, smiling. "I guess I'm lost," he said ruefully. Bob Hayward is a gruff man, not the sort of highway patrolman that a speeder or reckless driver would choose to meet. He looked closely at the man before him, a man who appeared to be about 25, who wore blue jeans, a black turtleneck pullover, tennis shoes, and longish wild hair.
"You ran two stop signs. Can I see your license and registration?"
"Sure." The man produced his ID. Hayward looked at the license. It had been issued to Theodore Robert Bundy at an address on First Avenue in Salt Lake City.
"What are you doing out here at this time of the morning?"
Bundy answered that he had been to see the Towering Inferno at the Redwood Drive-In and was on his way home when he'd become lost in the subdivision. It was the wrong answer. The drive-in, Bundy mentioned, was in Hayward's patrol area, and he'd driven by earlier that night. The Towering Inferno was not the picture playing there. As the burly sergeant and Bundy talked, two troopers from the highway patrol pulled up in back of Hayward's car, but remained inside, watching. Hayward seemed to be in no danger. Hayward glanced at the Volkswagen and noticed that for some reason the passenger seat had been removed and placed on its side in the back seat. He turned back to Bundy.
Mind if I look in your car?
Go ahead.
The highway patrol sergeant saw a small crowbar resting on the floor in back of the driver's seat and an open satchel sitting on the floor in front. He played his flashlight over the open satchel and saw some of the items inside. A ski mask, a crowbar, an ice pick, some rope, wire. They looked to Hayward like the tools of a burglar. Hayward placed Ted Bundy under arrest for evading an officer, frisked him, and handcuffed him. Then he called Salt Lake County for backup from a detective on duty. Deputy Daryl Ondrak had the third watch that night and responded to 2725 West 3500 South. He found troopers Hayward, Fife, and Twitchell waiting with Ted Bundy. Bundy maintains today that he gave no permission to search his car. Ondrak and Hayward say that he did.
I never said, yes, you have my permission to search, Ted says. But I was surrounded by a number of uniformed men. Sergeant Hayward, two highway patrolmen, two uniformed deputies. I wasn't exactly quaking in my boots, but I felt I couldn't stop them. They were intent and hostile, and they do what they damn well pleased.
Ondrak looked in the canvas satchel. He saw the ice pick, a flashlight, gloves, torn strips of sheeting, the knit ski mask, and another mask, a grotesque object made from a pair of pantyhose. Eye holes had been cut in the panty portion, and the legs were tied together on top. There was a pair of handcuffs, too. Ondrak checked the trunk and found some large green plastic garbage bags.
Where'd you get all this stuff? He asked Ted.
It's just junk I picked up around my house.
They look like burglar tools to me, Ondrak said flatly. I'm going to take these items, and I suspect the DA will be issuing a charge of possession of burglary tools.
According to Ondrak, Ted simply replied, fine. Detective Jerry Thompson met Ted Bundy face to face on that early morning of August 16, 1975. Thompson, tall, good-looking, perhaps 5 years older than Bundy, was later to become an important adversary. But now they barely glanced at each other. Thompson had other things to do, and Bundy was intent on bailing out and going home. He was released on PR, personal recognizance. It was the first time in his adult life that Ted Bundy had ever been arrested, and it had been such a chance thing. Had he not driven by the home of Sergeant Bob Hayward, had he not tried to run from the pursuing policeman, he would have been home safe. Why had he run? On August 18th, Thompson glanced over the arrest reports for the weekend. The name Bundy caught his eye. He'd heard it someplace before, but he couldn't quite place it. He hadn't even known the name of the man brought in early Saturday morning. And then he remembered. Ted Bundy was the man that the girl from Seattle had reported in December of 1974. Thompson read over the arrest report carefully. Bundy's car was a light-colored Volkswagen Bug. The list of items found in the car now struck him as much more unusual. He pulled out the Durant report and the Debbie Kent file. The handcuffs found in Bundy's car were Jana brand. The handcuffs on Carol Durant's wrist were Jerichol. But he wondered just how many men routinely carried handcuffs with them. There was the crowbar, similar to the iron bar that Durant had been threatened with. Ted Bundy was listed as being 5'11" tall, weighing 170 pounds. He was a law student at the University of Utah. Yes, that's what his girlfriend from Seattle had said, too. He'd been arrested in Granger, which was only a few miles from Midvale, where Melissa Smith had last been seen alive. There were more similarities, more common threads in front of Thompson than he'd yet had in his 10 months of trying to find the man with the Volkswagen, Officer Roseland. On August 21st, Ted was arrested on the added charges, possession of burglary tools. He did not appear to be visibly upset by the arrest and had deft explanations for the items found in his car. The handcuffs? He'd found them in a garbage dumpster. He'd used the pantyhose mask as protection under his ski mask against the icy winds of ski slopes. And didn't everyone own crowbars, ice picks, garbage bags? He seemed amused that the detectives would consider any of these things burglary tools. It was a posture that Ted Bundy would assume over and over again as the years passed. He was an innocent man accused of things that were unthinkable for him. The arrest by Sergeant Hayward on August 16th was the catalyst to a flurry of intense activity in the Salt Lake County Sheriff's Office during late August and September of 1975. Captain Pete Hayward and Detective Jerry Thompson felt they had their man in the Durranche kidnapping and suspected that Ted Bundy might well be the man who had taken Melissa, Laura, and Debbie away. Ted readily signed a permission to search form on his First Avenue apartment and accompanied Thompson and Sergeant John Bernardo as they scrutinized the neat rooms. It was not a forced search. There was no search warrant listing specific items. In essence, this meant that the detectives had no authority to remove anything from Ted's apartment, even if they should come across something they felt might be evidence. If they did, they would have to go to a judge and obtain a search warrant listing those items. Thompson glanced up at the bicycle wheel suspended from the meat hook, at the assortment of knives hanging from it. Then he glanced at the chopping block. Following Thompson's glance, Ted said mildly, "I like to cook." The detective saw the rows of law textbooks. A few months later, a Washington detective would comment to me that the Utah investigators had found a weird sex book in Ted's library. When I asked Ted about it later, he told me that he had Alex Comfort's Joy of Sex, and I laughed. I had a copy too, as did thousands of other people. It was hardly Croft Ebbing. There were other items in the apartment, seemingly innocuous but meaningful in the probe going on. There was a map of ski regions in Colorado, with a Wildwood Inn in Aspen marked, a brochure from the Bountiful Recreation Center. Question, Ted said he'd never been to Colorado, that a friend must have left the map. He thought he must have driven through Bountiful, Utah, but felt someone else had dropped the brochure in his apartment. Thompson insists today that he found patent leather shoes in Bundy's closet on that first visit, but when he returned later with a search warrant, they were gone. A television set and a stereo he had seen were also absent. If the two detectives had expected to find something solid to tie Ted with the murdered Utah victims, they were to be disappointed. There were no women's clothes, jewelry, or purses. When they had searched the whole place, Ted agreed to allow them to photograph his Volkswagen Bug parked in the rear of the building. It had dents and rust spots, a tear at the top of the rear seat. Bernardo and Thompson left. They felt they were closer to unraveling the truth, but were somewhat disconcerted by Ted Bundy's casual attitude. He certainly didn't appear concerned. One of Ted's women friends in Salt Lake City was Sharon Auer. She put him in touch with attorney John O'Connell, a tall, bearded man who affected a cowboy hat and boots. A respected criminal defense attorney in the Mormon City, O'Connell immediately put a lid on Ted's conversations with detectives. The lawyer called Thompson and said that Bundy would not come to their offices as scheduled on August 22nd. Although Ted would not talk to detectives any longer, his mugshot, along with several others, was shown to Carol Durranche and the drama teacher Jean Graham, who had seen the stranger just before Debbie Kent vanished forever. It had been 10 months, but Mrs. Graham chose Bundy from the stack of photos almost immediately. His mugshot showed him clean-shaven. She said that Ted Bundy was a ringer for the man she'd seen, and all that was missing was a mustache. Carol Durranche was not as definite. The first time she thumbed through the packet of photos, she set Ted's picture aside, but did not comment on it. When Thompson asked her why she had separated that photo from the others, she seemed reticent.
"Why did you pull that one out?" Thompson asked.
"I'm not sure. It looks something like him, but I really couldn't say for sure."
The next day, Bountiful Detective Ira Beale showed her a laydown of driver's license photos. In this group, Ted was depicted as he had looked in December 1974 and appeared quite different than the man in the mugshot taken in August of 1975. Ted was and is a man with a chameleon-like quality, his appearance changing dramatically in almost every picture taken of him, apparently through no conscious effort on his part. Carol looked at the second set of pictures. This time, she chose Ted Bundy's picture almost at once. Like the teacher, she remarked that he had had a mustache when she encountered him on November 8, 1974. The kidnapped victim's identification of Bundy's Volkswagen was less clear. She had seen the pictures taken of it several times, and by the time she was taken to view it, it had been sanded, the rust spots painted over, and the tear in the back of the seat mended. It had also been scrubbed and hosed down inside and out. Ted Bundy would never again be out of the constant attention of law enforcement agencies. He was not in jail, but he might as well have been. Surveillance units watched him continually during September of 1975, and wheels were turning behind the scenes. His gasoline credit card records had been requested, his school records were subpoenaed, and probably the most disastrous move as far as his future freedom was concerned, Utah detectives had contacted his fiancée, Meg Anders. Chapter 16. I had neither seen nor heard from Ted Bundy since the crisis clinic party in December 1973. And then my phone rang on an afternoon in late September 1975. It was Ted calling from Salt Lake City. I was surprised, but glad to hear his voice. I felt a sharp twinge of guilt when he began, "Ann, you're one of the few people I can really trust in Seattle." Great. I remember turning his name into Dick Reed in August of 1974 and wondered just how trustworthy he would find me if he knew that. But that had been a long time ago, and I hadn't heard a word about him since. I wanted to ask him what he was doing in Salt Lake City, but he had something on his mind.
"Listen, you have contacts with the police. Could you find out why they're subpoenaing my law school records down here?"
A dozen thoughts raced through my mind. Why now? Why after 13 months? Was Ted being investigated because of what I had done so long before? Had I implicated him in something that apparently had him very concerned? I had never heard of Carol Duranche, Melissa Smith, Laura Aim, or Debbie Kent. I was completely unaware of the Utah investigation, and it didn't seem possible that the task force would wait more than a year to follow up on a lead I had given. I answered slowly, "Ted, I probably could find out, but I wouldn't want to do anything underhanded. I'd have to tell them who wanted to know."
"No problem. I'm just curious. Go ahead and tell them that Ted Bundy wants to know. Call me back, collect, at 801-531-7733 if you find out anything."
I stared at the phone in my hand. I truly couldn't believe the conversation just finished. Ted had sounded exactly as he always had, cheerful and confident. I debated calling King County Police. I'd never interfered in their investigations, and I hesitated now. It was almost 4 o'clock, and the detectives would be going off shift within a few minutes. I called the county's major crimes unit, and Kathy McChesney answered. I explained that Ted Bundy was an old friend of mine, and that he had just called me requesting information about the subpoena. There was a long pause, and the receiver was covered while she conferred with someone in the office. Finally, she was back on the line.
Tell him that he's just one of 1,200 people being checked out, that it's just a routine inquiry."
They were stalling. Not me, but Ted. I'd been around police homicide units long enough to know that they wouldn't be requesting records from that many suspects, that something was definitely up. I didn't argue. Kathy was clearly uncomfortable.
"Okay, I'll tell him that."
Subpoenas are not issued without probable cause. Obviously something was happening, something big. I felt a chill. Not even a television script could make it believable that a crime writer could sign a contract to write a book about a killer and then have the suspect turn out to be her close friend. It wouldn't wash. I called Ted back that night, waited as the phone rang 6, 7, 8 times. Finally, he answered, panting.
"I had to run up the stairs. I was down on the front porch," he told me.
"I called them," I began, "and they said to tell you that you're only one of about 1,200 guys they're checking out."
"Oh, okay, great."
He didn't seem worried, but I wondered how somebody as sharp as Ted was could believe that. "If you have any more questions, they said you could just call them direct."
"Right."
"Ted, what's happening down there?"
"Nothing much. Oh, I got picked up on a Mickey Mouse thing in August by the state patrol. They're claiming I had burglary tools in my car, but the charge won't stand up."
Ted Bundy with burglary tools? Impossible. but he continued.
I think they have some kind of wild idea that I'm connected with some cases up in Washington. Do you remember something about some missing girls up there?
Of course I remembered. I'd been living with it since January of 1974. He claimed to have almost no knowledge of the cases, and he'd almost thrown away his last statement. It was as if he'd said he was wanted for a traffic violation in Washington. I didn't know what to say. I knew that whatever was coming down, it had to be based on more than my suggesting his name.
I'm going to be in a lineup tomorrow, he said. Everything's going to turn out all right, but if it doesn't, you'll be reading about me in the papers.
I couldn't understand how a lineup in Utah could have anything to do with the cases in Washington. He hadn't mentioned Carol Durant or the kidnapping case at all. If he was a suspect in Washington, he would be in a lineup in Seattle. The only people who could conceivably identify the Ted from Washington were the witnesses from Lake Sammamish, but something kept me from asking him more.
Hey, thanks. I'll keep in touch, he said, and we said goodbye.
On October 2nd, a brilliant golden blue autumn day, I attended a junior high school football game. My son, Andy, was starting at right end. He broke his thumb on the first play, but his team won, and we were in a good mood as we stopped at McDonald's for hamburgers on the way home. Back in the car, I switched on the radio. A bulletin interrupted the record playing. Theodore Robert Bundy, a former Tacoma resident, was arrested today in Salt Lake City and charged with aggravated kidnapping and attempted criminal assault. I must have gasped. My son looked at me.
Mom, what's wrong?
It's Ted, I managed to stammer.
Isn't that your friend from the crisis clinic?
Yes. He told me I might be reading about him in the papers. This time, there was to be no quick release on PR. Ted's bail was set at $100,000, and he was locked in the county jail. Detective Dick Reed called me that night.
You were right, he said.
I didn't want to be right. I didn't want to be right at all. I slept little that night. Even when I'd suggested Ted's name to Reed, I hadn't really visualized him as a man capable of violence. I hadn't allowed my thinking to go that far. I kept seeing Ted as I remembered him, picturing him hunched over the crisis clinic phones, hearing his warm, sympathetic voice. I tried to picture him now behind bars, and I couldn't. Early the next morning, I received a phone call from the Associated Press.
We have a message for Ann Rule transmitted over our wires from Salt Lake City.
This is Ann.
Ted Bundy wants you to know that he is all right, that things will work out.
I thanked them, hung up the phone, and it rang almost at once. First, a reporter from the Seattle Times wondering what my connection was with Ted Bundy. Was I a secret girlfriend? What could I say about Ted? I explained who I was, a writer, like the reporter calling. I've done several pieces for the Sunday Times magazine. Don't you know the name?
Oh yeah, Rule. So why did he send you that message over AP?
He's a friend. He wanted me to know he was all right. I didn't want to be quoted by name. I was still too confused by what had happened. Just say that the man I know couldn't be responsible for any of the things he's accused of. The next call followed immediately. It was a Seattle Post-Intelligencer who had also picked up the AP message. I repeated what I'd told the Times reporter. It was as if someone had died suddenly. People who had known Ted from the crisis clinic, Bob Vaughn, Bruce Cummins, John Eshelman, all calling to talk about it. And none of us believed Ted capable of what he'd been charged with. It was unthinkable. We kept recalling anecdotes about Ted, trying to convince each other that what we were reading in blaring headlines could not be happening. I didn't know then that Carol Durant, Jean Graham, and Debbie Kent's girlfriend, Jo Lynn Beck, who had seen the man in the auditorium on November 8th, had all picked Ted out of the Utah lineup on October 2nd. Ted had been one suspect, standing in a seven-man lineup, surrounded by detectives, all of them a little older, a little heavier than he was. The question would arise, was this a fair lineup? I wrote to Ted on October 4th, telling him of support from Seattle, of the calls from his friends, of the favorable statements being published in the Seattle papers, promising him that I would continue to write. I ended that letter. There is nothing in this life that is a complete tragedy. Nothing. Try to remember that. Looking back, I wonder at my naivete. Some things in this life are complete tragedies. Ted Bundy's story may well be one of them. I was about to become a part of Ted's life again. To this day, I do not know what tied us together. It was more than my zeal as a writer. It was more than his tendency to manipulate women who might be able to help him. There is a vast gray area somewhere in between that I have never been able to clearly define. His attorney, John O'Connell, called me during Ted's first week in jail, seeking information on the investigation in Washington. I could tell him nothing. That would have meant a betrayal of my responsibility to detectives in Seattle. All I could do was keep writing to Ted. Whatever his crimes might have been, whatever hidden things might someday be revealed, he seemed to need someone. I was beginning to be torn apart. And Ted began to write to me, long scrawled letters on yellow legal pad sheets. His first correspondence was full of his sense of displacement, letters from a young man who had never been in jail. He could not quite believe it. He was both astonished by his plight and outraged that he was quickly learning the ropes of survival inside. Much of his prose was turgid and overly dramatic, but he was caught in a situation that seemed impossible for Ted Bundy, and he could certainly be forgiven his tendency toward pathos. "My world is a cage," he wrote on October 8, 1975. "How many men before me have written these same words? How many have struggled vainly to describe the cruel metamorphosis that occurs in captivity? And how many have concluded that there are no satisfactory words to communicate their feelings except to cry, 'My God, I want my freedom!'" His cellmate was a 50-ish old-timer whom Ted saw as a star-crossed alcoholic. The man quickly set about teaching the kid the ropes. Ted had learned to hide his cigarettes, and when they were gone, to roll his own. He learned to tear matches in half, because matches didn't last long. He saved oranges, styrofoam cups, toilet paper, realizing he was dependent on the whim of the trustees for all the small things that made jail life a little more bearable. He learned to say please and sir when he wanted to make a phone call or needed an extra blanket or soap. He wrote that he was growing personally, however, that he was discovering new things about himself and through his quiet observation of his fellow prisoners. He praised his friend's loyalty and agonized over what the publicity surrounding him might be doing to those close to him. Still, he never lost sight of a happy ending. "The nighttime hours are the hard hours. I make them easier by dwelling on the building which must be done when the storm is past. I will be free. And someday, Anne, you and I will look upon this letter as a note from a nightmare." It was a note from a nightmare. The flowery, often trite phrases could not take away from the fact that being locked up was a kind of hell for Ted. I continued to write to him and to send whatever small checks I could manage for cigarette and canteen money. I didn't know what I believed, and all my letters were couched in terms that were deliberately ambiguous. They contained information on what was appearing in the local press, details about what I was writing, and on calls from mutual friends. I tried to block the pictures that occasionally seized my mind and shook it. I tried to think back to the old days. It was the only way I could respond to Ted as I always had. The second letter from the Salt Lake County Jail came on October 23rd, and much of it was a poem, countless stanzas on life in jail. He was still only an observer, not a participant. The poem rambled over both sides of 16 pages of the yellow legal paper. He called it Nights of Days, and it began, "This is no way to be. Man ought to be free. That man should be me." The meter often faltered, but the words all rhymed as he again bemoaned his lack of privacy in the cuisine in the jail, the omnipresent game shows and soap operas on the television set in the day room, programs which he termed visual brain cancer. He wrote, as he often would, of his belief in God. We had never talked about religion, but now Ted was apparently spending a lot of his time reading the Bible. Sleep comes on slowly. Read the words of the holy. The scriptures bring peace. They talk of release. They bring us to God. In here, that seems odd. But his gift is so clear, I find that he's near. Mercy and redemption without an exception. He puts me at ease. Jailer, do what you please. No harm can befall me when the Savior does call me. The endless poem talked of another release, sleep. He could forget the nightmare he was living, the bars and the screams of other prisoners when he slept. So he napped whenever possible. He was trapped in a caged human sea. Moving easily from the Bible to the menu in jail, a bit of his old humor surfaced. It makes me feel blue, taking food from the animals in the zoo. Pork chops tonight, Jews are uptight. I gave mine away. It still has a tail. And as for dessert, the cook, that old flirt, surprised us with mellow peach jello. For all his days in jail to come, he would decry jello. As for the other residents of the jail, Ted found them childlike, overgrown kids. Some really believe they were born to deceive, to make a bankroll from the money they stole. They do not relate to going it straight. Except when in court, they sometimes resort to making a plea for a new life and leniency. His own inner ordeal emerged at the end of the poem. The fear of the cage was there. Days of days, self-control pays. Don't lose your mind, panic's not kind. Days of days, my integrity stays. Was this poem contrived? Something to play on my sympathies, which really needed no stimulus at all? Or was it the true outpouring of Ted's anguish? In the fall of 1975, I was terribly confused, besieged on one side by detectives who felt sure that Ted was as guilty as hell, and on the other, by the man himself who insisted again and again that he was innocent and being persecuted. It was a dichotomy of emotions that would stay with me for a long, long time. At the time, I still felt that I might have caused Ted's arrest. It would be years before I learned that my information had been checked out and cleared early in the game and then buried in the thousands of slips of paper with names on them. It had not been my doubts, but Meg's which had pinned him to the wall. My mixed loyalties threatened to cost me a vital portion of my income. I heard via the grapevine that the King County Police wanted those two letters Ted was known to have sent me, and that if I didn't turn them over, I could forget about getting any more stories from that department. It would mean that a quarter of my work would be cut off, and I simply couldn't afford it. I went directly to Nick Mackey. I have heard rumors that if I don't turn over Ted's letters to the task force, your doors will be closed to me. I think I should tell you frankly how I feel and what is happening in my life. I told Nick that I had learned that my children's father was dying, that it would only be a matter of weeks or a few months at most. I've just had to explain that to my sons, and they don't want to believe it. They hate me because I had to put it into words to prepare them. He is so ill that I no longer have any financial support from him, and I'm trying to make it alone. If I can't write up county cases, I don't think I can hack it. Mackey is an infinitely fair man. More than that, he could empathize with me. He was raising two sons alone. He had lost his wife a few years earlier. What I was telling him struck a nerve, and we had been friends for years.
No one has ever said you would be barred from this department. I wouldn't allow it. You know you can believe me. You've always been fair to us, and we respect you for it. Of course we'd like to see those letters, but whether you turn them over or not, things will be like they always were here.
Nick, I said honestly, I have read those letters over and over, and I can't find anything in them that makes Ted sound guilty, even unconscious slips. If you'll let me ask him if you can see them, and if he agrees, I'll bring them to you immediately. That's the only fair way I can do it. Nick Mackey agreed. I called Ted and explained my problem, and he responded that of course I must let the county detective see his letters. He had nothing to fear from them, nothing to hide. I met with Mackey and Dr. John Berberick, the psychologist for the Seattle Police Department, and they studied the first letter and the second long poem. There seemed to be nothing inherent there that would be a subconscious or overt admission of guilt. Berberich, who is built like a basketball player, talked with me and Mackie over lunch. Was there anything I could remember about Ted's personality that made me suspicious? Anything at all? I searched back through the years and could find nothing. There was not the slightest incident that I could enlarge upon. He seemed to me to be a particularly fine young man, I responded. I want to help. I want to help the investigation, and I want to help Ted, but there just isn't anything weird about him, nothing that I ever saw. Ted is illegitimate, but he seems to have come to terms with that. I had thought that Ted might stop contacting me after I'd shown his letters to the detectives. He knew that I moved constantly in the circle of the very investigators who were trying to catch him in a slip. But his correspondence continued, and my ambivalence rose to a level where I was laboring under more stress than I could stand. In an attempt to sort out my feelings, to deal with that stress, I consulted a psychiatrist. I handed him the letters. I don't know what to do. I don't even know what my motivations really are. Part of me wonders if Ted Bundy is guilty, not only of the cases in Utah, but of the cases here in Washington. If that is true, then I can write the book I've contracted for, and write it from a position that any author would envy. I want that, selfishly for my own career, and because it would mean financial independence. I could send my children to college, and we could move to a house that isn't falling down around our ears. He looked at me.
And?
And, on the other side of it, the man is my friend. But am I supporting him emotionally, writing to him because I just want to solve all those murders? Because I owe something to my detective friends, too? Am I, in essence, trying to trap him? Am I being unfair? Do I have the right to correspond with Ted when I have a niggling feeling that he might be guilty? Am I playing straight with him?
Let me ask you a question, he countered. If Ted Bundy proves to be a murderer, if he is sent to prison for the rest of his life, what would you do? Would you stop writing to him? Would you drop him?
That answer was easy. No. No, I would always write to him. If what the detectives believe is true, if he is guilty, then he needs someone. If he had that on his conscience, no, I would keep writing, keep in touch.
Then that's your answer. You're not being unfair.
There's another thing. I can't understand why Ted is reaching out to me now. I haven't seen or heard from him in almost 2 years. I didn't even know he'd moved away from Seattle until he called me just before his arrest. Why me? The psychiatrist tapped the letters.
From these, I get that he apparently looks upon you as a friend, perhaps as a kind of mother figure. He needs to communicate with someone he feels is on his intellectual level, and he admires you as a writer. There is the possibility of a more manipulative side. He knows you are close to the police, and he may want to use you as a conduit to them, without his actually having to talk to them himself. If he has committed these crimes, he is probably an exhibitionist, and one day he'll want his story told. He senses that you would do that in a manner that would portray the whole man.
I felt somewhat better after that visit. I would try not to look ahead, but I would keep up my contacts with Ted. He knew about my book contract. I hadn't lied. If he chose to stay close to me, then I would let him call the shots. Chapter 17. If I was feeling guilty and somewhat disloyal to Ted during fall 1975, Meg Anders was going through sheer hell. The information she had given to the Salt Lake County Sheriff's Office had been discounted until Ted's first arrest on August 16th. Now, detectives in Utah, Colorado, and Washington were anxious to know everything Meg remembered about Ted, all the bits and pieces of information that had made her suspect her lover. They were trying to find the man responsible for the most brutal series of killings in their memories, and it looked very much indeed as if Ted Bundy was that man. Ted's privacy, Meg's privacy, did not matter any longer. Meg had adored Ted from the moment she met him in the Sandpiper Tavern. She never had been able to understand what it was that made him stay with her. She'd had an overwhelming sense of failure for most of her life. She'd always felt she was the one member of her immediate family who hadn't lived up to their expectations. Everyone but Meg worked in a prestigious profession, and she considered herself only a secretary. The love of a brilliant man like Ted had helped to assuage her feelings of inferiority, and she was about to see that relationship exposed to merciless probing. Neither the Salt Lake County investigators nor the Seattle Task Force detectives liked what they had to subject Meg Anders to, the questioning that would delve into the most intimate details of her life, the slow tearing down of all that she had built up in the 6 years before. But one thing was apparent. Meg Anders knew more about the hidden Ted Bundy than anyone alive, with the possible exception of Ted himself. On September 16th, Jerry Thompson and Dennis Couch from the Salt Lake County Sheriff's Office and Ira Beal from the Bountiful Utah Police Department had flown to Seattle to talk with Meg. They had first spoken with her father in Utah, who suggested that it might be of inestimable value to the investigation if they would speak directly with Meg. Thompson was aware that Meg's doubts about Ted had predated the murders in Utah, had gone all the way back to the disappearance of Janice Ott and Denise Naslund in July of 1974. The three Utah detectives met Meg in an interview room in the King County Police Major Crime Unit's offices. They noted her nervousness, the terrible emotional strain she was under. But they also saw that she was determined to lay out all the information that had led her finally to the police. Meg lit the first of a whole pack of cigarettes that she would smoke during the long interview. She stated firmly that she did not want the proceedings recorded on tape.
"Ted went out a lot in the middle of the night," she began, "and I didn't know where he went. Then he napped during the day, and I found things, things that I couldn't understand."
"What sort of things?"
"A lug wrench taped halfway up under the seat of my car. He said it was for my protection. Plaster of Paris in his room. Crutches. He had an oriental knife in a kind of wooden case that he kept in the glove compartment of my car. Sometimes it was there, sometimes it was gone. He had a meat cleaver. I saw him pack it when he moved to Utah."
Meg related that Ted had never been with her on the nights the girls in Washington had vanished.
"After I saw the composite pictures of Ted in the paper in July of 1974, I checked back through the papers in the library to get the dates the girls disappeared, and I checked my calendar and my canceled checks, and he just was never around then."
Meg said she had been more afraid after her friend Lynn Banks returned from Utah in November of 1974.
"She pointed out that the cases down there were just like the ones up here, and she said, 'Ted's in Utah now.' That's when I called my father and asked him to get in touch with you down there." "Will you tell Ted that I've told you all this?" Meg asked Thompson as she lit another cigarette.
"No, we won't," the detective promised. "What about you? Will you tell him?"
"I really don't think I will. I keep praying about it, and I keep praying you'll find out. And I guess I keep hoping that you'll find out it's not Ted, that it's someone else. But deep down, I'm just not sure."
Asked to explain her doubts in detail, Meg talked about the plaster of Paris she'd seen in Ted's room at the Rogerses.
"I confronted him about it, and he told me he'd stolen it from that medical supply place where he was working. He said he didn't know why. Just for the hell of it, he said. He said the crutches were for his landlord."
Meg said that she'd once found a paper sack full of women's clothing in Ted's room.
"The top item was a bra, a large-size bra. The rest was just clothing, girls' clothes. I never asked him about it. I was afraid and kind of embarrassed."
The detectives asked Meg if Ted had changed in any way in the last year or so, and she told them that his sexual drive had diminished to almost nothing during the summer of 1974, of his explanations about work pressures.
"He said there was no other woman."
The questions were excruciatingly embarrassing for Meg.
"Had he changed in any other way in his sexual interests?"
She looked down.
"He got this book, this Joy of Sex book, sometime in December 1973. He read about anal intercourse, and he insisted on trying it. I didn't like it, but I went along with him. Then there was something in that book about bondage. He went right to the drawer where I kept my nylons. He seemed to know which drawer they were in."
Meg said she had allowed herself to be tied to the four bedposts with the nylon stockings before having sex. The whole thing had been distasteful to her. She had acquiesced three times, but during the third occasion, Ted had started to choke her and she'd panicked.
"I wouldn't do that anymore. He didn't say much, but he was unhappy with me when I said no more."
"Anything else?"
Meg was mortified, but she continued.
"Sometimes, after I was asleep at night, I'd wake up and find him under the covers. He was looking at my body with a flashlight.
Does Ted like your hair the way it is now? Ira Beale asked.
Meg's hair was long and straight, parted in the center.
Yes, whenever I talk about cutting it, he gets very upset.
He really likes long hair. The only girl I've seen for sure that he dated besides me has hair just like mine.
The three detectives exchanged glances. Does Ted always tell you the truth? Thompson asked.
Meg shook her head. I've caught him in several lies. He told me that he was arrested down there for a traffic violation, and I told him I knew that wasn't the truth, that there'd been items in the car that looked like burglary tools. He just said they didn't mean too much, that it was an illegal search.
Meg told them that she knew Ted had stolen in the past.
I know he stole a television in Seattle and some other things. One time, just one time, he told me if I ever told anyone about it that he'd break my fucking neck.
Meg said that she was in constant touch with Ted, that she had spoken to him only the night before, and that he'd been his old, tender self again, telling her how much he loved her, planning their marriage.
He needs money, $700 for his attorney, $500 for tuition. He still owes Frieda Rogers $500.
Meg knew, too, that Ted's cousin had told him that he was illegitimate when Ted was 18 or 19.
It really upset him. Nobody had ever told him before.
Does Ted ever wear a mustache? Beale asked her suddenly.
No, sometimes a full beard. Oh, he had a fake mustache. He used to keep it in his drawer. Sometimes he stuck it on and asked me how he looked in it.
The interview ended. Meg had smoked an entire pack of cigarettes. She had pleaded with the Utah investigators to tell her that Ted could not be involved, but they couldn't. The picture of Ted Bundy that was emerging was far different than that of the perfect son, the modern-day prototype of a Horatio Alger hero. Meg Anders was living a dual existence, something that was intolerable for her, something that was standard for her lover. She talked often to Ted on the phone, and he played down the police interest in him, even though as he talked, he was under constant surveillance by the Utah lawmen. And she continued to answer questions put to her by the detectives, who were trying to place him during all those essential time periods, some of them now a year and a half before. July 14, 1974 was an infamous day in Washington, the day that Janice Odd and Denise Naslund had vanished from Lake Sammamish State Park. Meg remembered that Sunday.
We'd had an argument the night before. I was surprised to see him that morning. He came over and I told him I was going to church and then planned to lie out in the sun. We quarreled again that morning. We just weren't getting along. I was really surprised to see him later.
Ted had called Meg sometime after 6 that evening and asked her to go out to eat. Was there anything unusual about him that night?
He looked exhausted, really wiped out. He was getting a bad cold. I asked him what he'd done that day because he was so tired out, and he said he'd just lain around all day.
Ted had removed a ski rack from his car, a rack that belonged to Meg, and placed it back on her car that night. After they'd gone out to eat, he'd fallen asleep on her floor and gone home at 9:15. Beale and Thompson wondered if it was possible. Could a man leave his girlfriend on a Sunday morning, abduct, rape, and kill 2 women, and then return casually to his friend's home and take her out to dinner? They questioned Meg again about Bundy's sex drive. Was he, they tried to phrase it tactfully, was he the kind of man who normally had several orgasms in a period of lovemaking?
Oh, a long time ago when we first started going together, but no, not lately. He was just normal.
Thompson made a decision. He pulled out a picture of all the items found in Ted's car when he'd been arrested by Sergeant Bob Hayward on August 16th. Meg studied them. Have you ever seen any of these things?
I haven't seen that crowbar. I've seen the gloves and the gym bag. Usually it's empty. He carries his athletic supplies in it.
Did you ever confront him about the taped lug wrench that you found in your car?
Yeah, he said you never know when you can get caught in the middle of a student riot.
Where was it kept? Thompson asked.
Usually in the trunk of my car. He borrowed my car a lot. It was a Volkswagen Bug, too, a tan one. Once I saw the wrench under the seat in front.
Meg recalled that Ted had often slept in his car in front of her house.
I don't know why. He was just there. This was a long time ago,
and there was a crowbar or a tire iron or something that he left in my house one night. I heard him come back in, and I opened the door to see what he wanted. He looked really sick, like he was hiding something, and I said, "What have you got in your pocket?" He wouldn't show me. I reached in and pulled out a pair of surgical gloves. Weird. He didn't say anything. It seems incredible now that I didn't just say, "Go away." It was weird. But until the events of 1974 and 1975, Meg had never connected Ted's nocturnal habits to anything definite. Like so many other women in love, she had simply put it all out of her mind. Chapter 18. Ted wrote me in October 1975 that he felt as if he were in the eye of a hurricane. And indeed, he had been in the center of some manner of storm ever since his arrest in August. I hadn't known of this arrest until he phoned me at the end of September, and he had passed it off with a shrug to me, just as he had with Meg and his other Washington friends. It would be a long time before I learned of the investigation that went on throughout the entire autumn. Once in a great while in the years ahead, a detective would let something slip and then say hastily, "Forget I said that." I didn't forget. But I didn't tell anyone what I'd heard, and I most assuredly didn't write anything about it. Occasionally, odd bits and pieces would leak to the press. But the entire story would never be known to me until after the Miami trial, 4 years hence. As it was, having only fragments of the story, I tried to withhold judgment. Had Ted been a complete stranger to me, as all the other suspects I'd written about had been, resolution of my feelings might have come sooner. I don't believe it was because I was dense. Better minds than mine continued to support him. In each case that I researched after the Ted murders, each young woman's murder where a suspect was arrested, I traced back to see where that man had been on the days of crimes where Ted was a suspect. And for the Ted crimes, the men had solid alibis. By the fall of 1975, there were more than a dozen detectives in Washington, Utah, and Colorado working full-time on Ted Bundy. Captain Pete Hayward and Detective Jerry Thompson from the Salt Lake County Sheriff's Office. Detective Mike Fisher from the Pitkin County District Attorney's Office in Aspen, Colorado. Detective Sergeant Bill Baldridge from the Pitkin County Sheriff's Office. Detective Milo Vig from the Mesa County Sheriff's Office in Grand Junction, Colorado. Detective Lieutenant Ron Ballantyne and Detective Ira Beale from the Bountiful Utah Police Department. Captain Nick Mackey and Detectives Bob Keppel, Roger Dunn, and Kathy McChesney from the King County, Washington Sheriff's Office. Detective Sergeant Ivan Beeson, and Detectives Ted Fonis and Wayne Dorman from the Seattle Police Homicide Unit. Ted had stated to Jerry Thompson and John Bernardo that he had never been to Colorado, had explained away the maps and brochures of the ski areas by saying, "Somebody must have left them in my apartment." Mike Fisher, in checking Bundy's credit card slips, found that that was not true. Moreover, he was able to place Bundy's car, the VW Bug bearing two separate sets of plates, in Colorado on the very days that the victims in that state had vanished, and within a few miles of the sites of the disappearances. The Chevron Oil Company duplicate records noted that Ted had purchased gas as follows. On January 12, 1975, the day Karen Campbell disappeared from the Wildwood Inn in Glenwood Springs, Colorado. On March 15, 1975, the day Julie Cunningham walked away from her apartment forever, in Golden, Dillon, and Silverthorne, Colorado. On April 4, 1975, in Golden, Colorado. On April 5th, in Silverthorne. And on April 6th, the day Denise Oliverson vanished, in Grand Junction, Colorado. But only once had Ted ever been seen, and that was in Lake Sammamish State Park on July 14, 1974. The King County detectives began to chart as much of Ted Bundy's life as they could ferret out. That was why his law school records had been subpoenaed. Because their probe into Ted had been carried out with a minimum of fanfare, Detective Kathy McChesney had been very startled when I had called her at Ted's behest. The investigators had not known that Ted was even aware that he was under suspicion in Washington. At the same time that Ted's Utah law school records were subpoenaed, his telephone records were requested from Mountain Bell in Salt Lake City, records going back to September 1974 when he'd first moved to Utah. Kathy McChesney asked if I would come in for an interview in early November 1975.
She had been given the assignment of interviewing the women Ted had known in Seattle, however peripherally. Again, I repeated, this time for the record, the circumstances under which I'd met Ted, our work at the crisis clinic, our close but sporadic friendship over the intervening years.
"Why do you think he called you just before his arrest in Salt Lake City?" she asked.
"I think it was because he knew that I worked with you all the time, and I don't think he wanted to talk to detectives directly." Kathy thumbed through a stack of papers, pulled one out, and said suddenly,
"What did Ted say to you when he called you on November 20th, 1974?
I looked at her blankly. "When?"
"Last year, on November 20th.
"Ted didn't call me," I answered truthfully. "I hadn't talked to Ted since sometime in 1973.
"Yes, we have his telephone records. There's a call to your number a little before midnight on Wednesday, November 20th. What did he say?"
I had known Kathy McChesney since we had both been in the King County Police Basic Homicide School in 1971. She is a deputy sheriff and myself as an invited auditor. She had been promoted to detective, although she looked more like a high school girl, and she was sharp. I'd interviewed her countless times when she worked in the sex crimes unit. I wasn't trying to evade her question, but I was puzzled. It's difficult to remember what you were doing on a particular date a whole year before. And then it dawned on me. Kathy, I wasn't home that night. I was in the hospital because I'd had an operation the day before. But my mother told me about a funny call. It was a call from a man who wouldn't leave his name, and yeah, it was on November 20th. That mystery was solved, but I have often wondered since if the events to follow might have somehow been different if I had been home to take that call. In the years ahead, I would receive dozens of phone calls from Ted, calls from Utah, Colorado, Florida, as well as scores of letters, and we would have several face-to-face meetings. I would be caught up in his life again, torn between belief in him completely and the doubts that grew stronger and stronger. Kathy McChesney believed me. I'd never lied to her, and I never would. If I'd known who the man was who'd called me, I would have told her. Ted also made two other calls on the night of November 20th, two calls between 11 and midnight. Although he had broken his secret engagement to Stephanie Brooks in January of that year, sent her away without any apologies or explanations, he had placed a call to her parents' home in California at 11:03 p.m. Stephanie hadn't been there. A woman friend of the family recalls that she talked to a friendly-sounding man who asked for Stephanie. "I told him that Stephanie was engaged and living in San Francisco, and he hung up." Ted had next dialed an Oakland residence where none of the occupants had ever heard of Ted Bundy or Stephanie Brooks. The couple who lived there had no contacts in Seattle or Utah, and the man who answered figured it had been a wrong number. By the time Ted reached my number in Seattle, he'd been very upset, according to my mother. In wondering who that call might have been from, Ted's name had never entered my mind. Now, as Kathy asked me about it, I knew that the timing of the midnight call might be imperative. Ted had called me 12 days after Carol Durant had escaped her kidnapper and after Debbie Kent had vanished, 20 days after Laura Aim disappeared, a month after someone spirited Melissa Smith away. "I wish I'd been home that night," I told Kathy.
"So do I."
Kathy's assignments took her to the elder Bundy's residence in Tacoma. They believed none of the charges against their son. There would be no permission to search their home or the area around their cabin on Crescent Lake. What was unthinkable would not be helped along by the Bundys, and there was no probable cause to obtain search warrants. Freda Rogers, Ted Bundy's landlady for 5 years, was also fiercely protective of him. From the day he had located his room at 4143 12th NE by knocking on doors, Freda had liked him. He had been a good tenant, more like a son than a roomer, often putting himself out to help them. His room in the southwest corner of the old house had rarely been locked, and it was cleaned every Friday by Freda herself. Surely if he had something to hide, she reasoned, she would have sensed it.
"His things are all gone. He moved everything out in September of 1974. Look around if you like, but you won't find anything."
Detectives Roger Dunn and Bob Keppel checked the Rogers' house from top to bottom, even climbing up into the attic. If anything had been hidden up there, the insulation would have been disturbed, and it had not been. They moved over the grounds with metal detectors, looked for spots where something might have been buried. Clothes, jewelry, parts of a bicycle. There was nothing. Kathy McChesney talked with Meg Anders. Meg produced checks that Ted had written in 1974. They were not incriminating in the least, simply small checks written for groceries. Meg's own checks helped her to isolate what she had done on particularly important days and to determine whether she had seen her fiancé on those days. Asked about the plaster of Paris she had seen in Ted's room, Meg said she'd seen it first a long time ago, perhaps in 1970.
But I saw a hatchet under the front seat of his car, a hatchet with a pinkish leather cover in the summer of 1974, and the crutches. I saw them in May or June of 1974. He said they belonged to Ernst Rogers. We'd been to Green Lake one day. I asked him about the hatchet because it bothered me. I can't remember what his explanation was, but it made sense at the time. It was in August of 1974. I'd just come back from a trip to Utah. He was talking about getting a rifle that day. The cleaver and the meat tenderizer, I saw those when he was packing, and the Oriental knife. He said someone gave him the knife as a present.
Can you think of anything else that bothered you? McChesney asked.
Well, it didn't then, but he always kept two pair of mechanic's overalls and a toolbox in the trunk of his car.
Did Ted have any friends at Evergreen College in Olympia?
Just Rex Stark, the man he worked with on the crime commission. Rex was on the campus in 1973 and 1974, and Ted stayed some nights with him when he worked in Olympia. Rex had a place on a lake there.
Did he have friends in Ellensburg?
Jim Paulus. He knew him from high school. And his wife. We visited them once.